called Sthita Prajna. Prajna means wisdom, mind, intellect, etc. Sthita means steady, calm and quiet. Now this idea is explained in a very famous verse in this section. Towards the end of this section, a man of steady wisdom is compared to an ocean, and all the thought currents that enter or that arise in his mind are compared to waves or different rivers which flow towards the ocean. Now, he may see different objects all around him. He may engage himself in different actions. He may be busy 24 hours of the day, but he remains calm and quiet, like an ocean which is being ever filled with rivers, with water. But the ocean remains steady within its bounds. It never overflows. That is the state of mind of a man of steady wisdom. He may live in this world, he may be active 24 hours of the day, 7 days of the week, 365 days of the year, but still these actions and all that he has to confront in his daily life have no effect on him. He may react to them, he may also solve his problems in life, he may also work for his family, he may also be an efficient official or a teacher or a professor, a lawyer or a farmer, whatever may be his profession. But within him, his mind remains calm, quiet and tranquil. Just as an ocean rivers calm and quiet, it remains confined to its bounds. It never overflows. Any number of rivers may bring any amount of water, and the ocean is being constantly filled with water, but he is not affected. Now the question arises, how does such a man work in this world? Because we know very well that in ordinary life situations, every action, every work produces some kind of sensation in our mind. Now, for a man of steady wisdom, there is no work. Everything is an act of meditation, or everything is an act of worship. So, Vedanta scriptures analyze the dynamics of human activity from three standpoints. For a beginner, for a spiritual seeker, he may meditate in the morning and evening, or maybe 3-4 times a day. He may pray, he may read sacred books, he may pray in a temple or in a church or whatever may be the place of worship. He may engage in some kind of religious activity, spiritual activity. I would say spiritual rather than religious. Even if he is a good philanthropist working for the welfare of poor people, he is actually engaging himself in a spiritual activity. Now, for a beginner, there is always a line of demarcation between action and spirituality, work and worship. So you worship for, or worship, I mean the word worship stands for all the activities related to, say, spiritual life. He may pray for an hour, or meditate for an hour in the morning, or maybe in the evening. So 2 hours. The rest of the time he's engaged in different kinds of activities. So naturally he sees that there is a difference between work and worship. This is the beginning stage. Of course, remember, though it's a beginning stage, It is an advanced stage from an ordinary point of view. For people who can never even intellectually conceive of worship or spirituality, this is certainly an advanced stage. Now, so work and worship, secular life and spiritual life, a line of demarcation. Now, when he advances to a higher level, he is able to see work as worship. This is an advanced stage of spiritual life. For great thinkers, for great philanthropists, all these great men whom the world respect and honor, even centuries after their passing away, Gandhiji, Lincoln, or anybody, any of the great men, not necessarily those who are formerly known as spiritual saints like Saint Francis or Shankaracharya or Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, even great men who worked for great political causes, social causes, philanthropical causes, or great moral causes. Could be Lincoln, it could be Gandhi, it could be anyone. Now, for those great men, whether they formally proclaimed or not, work was an act of worship. So work as worship is the second stage of human evolution for a man of spiritual wisdom, who ultimately reaches this high level of tranquility and peace and happiness, a kind of inner happiness. It is not, well, for want of a better term, we may call it supreme happiness, supreme bliss, or contentment, whatever you may call. It is not the feeling of joy that you get when you procure something which you were looking for. It's not that. It's a kind of inner experience. And remember, experience can never be explained. Experience can only be experienced. Experience has no words. In fact, supposed to be the most ancient spiritual work of Vedantic tradition, and is also one of the most ancient works in the world. It is called Rigveda Samhita. Many of you must have heard. There is a famous verse. The great sages of ancient India, in one of his songs, hymns, says, Antaya Bahuvadinam Anantaya Moham. This is a part of his song. It says, the language of the infinite, that means experience, is silence, and the language of the finite is verbosity. So you can write volumes and volumes, you can speak for hours on finite things, because they are within the framework of definition or description or explanation, verbalization. But what is beyond words, what is infinite, is beyond expression. So the language of the infinite is silence. That is what it means. The language of the infinite, that what is beyond the finite, is silence. Now, at the second stage, a spiritual seeker, a man who is supposed to be a man of steady wisdom, he may be called a Sthita Prajna in Sanskrit, a man of steady wisdom, or he may be called a yogi. You know, yogi is not one who does the physical exercise of Hatha Yoga. What it implies, those who look upon yoga as a philosophy of life, as a way of life, as a means to reach the ultimate supreme bliss. That's what is meant by yoga here. Now, he may be a yogi, he may be a man of steady wisdom, or he may be a mystic. So if you read the works of Meister Eckhart, one of the classic examples you find, most of his expressions can be put into the classical Advaitic works, the works of non-dualistic philosophy of ancient India, and people won't even be confused. Means it's so close to the mystical literature of Vedanta tradition. So at the second stage, work is looked upon as worship. Now the third stage and most advanced stage, worship alone exists. There is no work. Because even the fine line of demarcation between work and worship also vanishes. So you don't have to look upon work as worship, because there is no work at all. Every act is experienced to be non-different from worship. So every thought becomes an act of meditation. Every work becomes an act of worship. It is not looked upon as worship, rather it is experienced to be worship itself. So, for such an advanced spiritual seeker, the whole life becomes an act of worship. So in one of the ancient hymns of Shankaracharya, who is the most well-known and the greatest commentator on the Gita, he says, every act of physical movement is like going around the Supreme Reality. I mean, going circumambulation, it is called in ancient India. They go around a temple in a clockwise manner. Circumambulation. So every moment is like going around the sacred spot, because there is no place in the world where God is not present. And every thought is an act of meditation. So if that means work itself ceases to exist, worship alone exists. This is the characteristic of a man of the highest spiritual wisdom. So, the Gita verse is the 70th verse. Apuryamanam achala pradishtam samudra mapa pravishanti yadvat tadurkamayam pravishanti sarve sa shantim apnodi na kama kami. The last word is sa shantim, means he attains a supreme happiness, supreme peace, supreme tranquility. That's the literal translation of this verse. Now, in one of our greatest devotional classics, there is a graphic description of how a great spiritual personality can learn spiritual life from nature itself. Nature itself becomes the teacher and the instructor. If you look upon nature as lifeless entities, the nature becomes something that people want to enjoy, to exploit, to conquer for increasing physical comforts. But a great spiritual person can look upon the world, natural phenomena, and entire creation as a great spiritual teacher. This is a long description. In ancient times, there was a great king. His name was Yadu. And one day, this great king was going through a forest. And then he comes across a great sage of ancient India. And seeing him, he was surprised. He was not very old, but there was so much of joy and happiness and so much of supreme bliss, so much of effulgence that you could feel on this man's face. So this king was well versed in all mystical literature, Gita, Upanishads and all that. So he puts a question to this sage. When All other human beings are either enjoying or suffering, you seem to have reached a stage of inner peace and happiness and blissfulness, which is not available in this world of senses, sensory objects. What is the secret of your tranquility and peace? This is a question he puts. The verse is this: Janeshu Dakshyamaneshu Kama Lobha Bhavagnina Na Tapyasi Agnina Mukto Ganga Bhasta Iva Dipa. I am quoting this verse because the verse is very, very beautiful and gives a graphic description and uses a great example, simile. So he says, the whole world is like a forest on fire. And when forest is on fire, all the living beings try to run away from the fire, or they will be burned to death. So they are struggling to run away from this terrible forest fire. But you are like an elephant which is swimming in the middle of the river Ganga. River Ganga is an ancient, it's a famous river in India, you know, the cities. So this king was walking through a forest on the banks of river Ganges, Ganga. And suddenly he found this man. So he says, you are like an elephant which is safe, perfectly safe from these terrible scorching heat of forest fire. And forest fire is this world. Of course, the king is a bit negative in his approach. Maybe he had some domestic problems. So he takes a very, very skeptical view of the world. But he had all power, all wealth, all comforts, but there was no peace. Maybe in those days, his kingdom was one of the most prosperous kingdoms in ancient India. So he was a very powerful emperor, full of power, glory, comforts, everything. There was nothing that he could not get in this world, but still he felt something terribly wanting within him, an inner emptiness, inner bankruptcy, voidness. So, and in front of him he found a young man, not a very old man, walking about. And in those verses, this sage is compared to a child, you know, not a child is not baby will be crying all the time, and a grown up boy also will not be very happy, but during between this, a child is a child of nature, childlike simplicity and happiness and joy. The whole world is it will present itself as a playground for a child. So this man was wandering in the forests, but the king could see, well, there is something with this man which is spectacular, because so much of joy, peacefulness, tranquility and perfect happiness. So what is the way to this happiness? How can I enjoy this inner tranquility and happiness? And he compares the king, as I said, as an elephant which is safe from the forest fire, because it is swimming in the middle of the Ganga river and the whole forest is on fire. Now, in response to this question, the sage unveils what is recognized to be one of the greatest spiritual sermon available in Sanskrit language. This comes in one of the most important and famous devotional classics of Vedantic tradition. It's called Bhagavata Purana. In the 11th book you find, 7th chapter. And in response to this, the sage says, now you know, I look upon entire world as my guru, as my teacher. If you can look upon nature with the right attitude, you can find nature itself becomes a teacher. The scientist may look upon a flower as something to be analyzed scientifically. A poet may see something sublime, something grand, something beautiful, but a gardener may see a flower, something that should be cared for, but nothing more than that. A poet may enjoy something in a flower which a gardener may not be able to enjoy. So this is with regard to the empirical world. So at the spiritual level, if you look upon nature itself from a proper standpoint, nature itself unveils some of the most sublime spiritual secrets. That is what is explained here. So the first teacher, this great sage, is earth itself. Now, how does earth become a teacher? So he says, look at this earth. The earth is the very embodiment of love for others, patience, and perfect equanimity of attitude. All the mountains, all the rivers, all the valleys, all that you find on earth are to be enjoyed, are meant for the enjoyment of other people. Earth itself doesn't seek any enjoyment. But this is, mind you, this is the attitude of a spiritual seeker. The question may arise, how can we look upon earth as a teacher? So once we look upon the earth as not as something to be exploited, but as the very embodiment of self-sacrifice, self-effacement, patience, and a sense of love for others, then earth itself becomes a teacher. So the sage says, the rivers flowing on the earth are meant for the good of other living beings. And then the forests, they are meant for the good of animals living in the forests. So practically the earth itself is one of the greatest examples of the motherly love, not meant for exploitation. So from this I understood that the way to peace is a perfect sense of love, and love for other human beings, and supreme patience, self-sacrifice. So I find the earth as an embodiment of all these virtues. This, so he says, earth is my first teacher. He lists no less than 24 teachers. 24. Earth, air, water, sky, fire, and different animals, all this. Philosophically, it's very important. If we can develop an inner spiritual attitude, then world itself can become a teacher. In support of this, I can quote another very important verse from Yajurveda. There a small boy goes to his father. The boy is the disciple and also the son, and the father is the teacher and also his father. So the boy asks him, please teach me the way to supreme peace, supreme happiness, the supreme truth. Now what does the father say? Father tells him, look around and see these material phenomenal empirical objects. Where do they come from? How do they exist? And where do they ultimately terminate? What happens to them in future? If you can understand the source and the power which sustains them, and also the point of their dissolution, you can understand the supreme truth. The verse is this: Annam Pranam Chakshu Srotram Mano Vachamiti. It means material objects, vital energy, air, water, everything that you experience in this world. Where do they come from? And what sustains them? If you can see an effect, you should always think of a cause. In Vedantic tradition, we do not arbitrarily posit a physical God and then try to explain how he created this world. In Vedantic tradition, we look around and we observe the empirical phenomena around us, then ask the question, well, what could be the original source of all this. If there is an inherent, invisible symphony behind this music of human existence, there should be a great musician who regulates and who controls this universe. So, from effect, we proceed to the cause. That is the Vedantic approach. So, you don't have to believe in anything. You don't have to believe. But you have to go and look around you and observe the life around you. Not only human life, but also the natural phenomena. And then try to find out where are they coming from. Even if a child walking the seashore may ask his father, where does this ocean come from? That question is as philosophical as the question which was asked in one of the ancient scriptures. See, it means, where are all these living beings coming from? In the Prasna Upanishad, there is a question. One student asked the question. And in answer to this question, the father says, try to find out, think of where they come from. What could be the source of all these things? And then he says, you can find an answer not by making an inquiry in the external world, but by making an inquiry in the inner world through meditation. And then this boy starts meditating. And he meditates for a long time. Then he comes to a conclusion, his own conclusion. Well, this matter is everything. There is nothing beyond this matter. All that you experience through your five senses and mind, all that exists. There is nothing beyond this. And he went to his father and told him, well, I have discovered the source of the entire creation. Matter itself is the only reality. The father said, no, you are wrong. You continue your meditation. And again he meditated maybe for maybe several months more. And then he discovered, well, vital energy is the source of everything. Because it is this energy which energizes, which activates the entire world. A plant, if you plant a seed, it sprouts within a short time and becomes a tree. So there is something in this world which activates the entire empirical phenomena. So it is called prana, means vital energy. And he went and told his father, I have discovered the truth. And the father said, no, you are wrong. You again continue your meditation. And he continued his meditation. At the third stage, he thought, mind is everything, because it is human mind which conceives everything. You know, anybody who says psychology, so long as it exists in your mind, it exists. If it doesn't exist in your mind, it no longer exists. So he said, mind is everything. Everything is a result of human mental speculation. Father said, no. And the fourth stage, the boy thought, human intellect is the source of everything. It's called Vijnanam, it's called in Tibu. Then also the father corrected him, you are wrong, you should continue your meditation. At the fifth stage, he meditated for a long time, not in one day, mind you, it has taken several years. And ultimately, he came to the father, and there was no further question. But father could see that the boy has ultimately discovered the truth, because there was so much of contentment, peace and tranquility in his face. He could not explain anything, because when you experience something and when you are trying to explain it, there is a contradiction, because experience can never be explained. Experience can only be experienced. So according to Vedantic tradition, all the books are only attempts to explain what is beyond explanation. Then why do we study this? To understand that these external phenomena, these empirical phenomena, are not the whole reality. There is something beyond this. And this reality can be experienced only through meditation. So this was the lesson which the sage learned from earth itself. And then he said, my second teacher is air. Then how does air become wind? How does it become your teacher? Now, the wind blows everywhere. It is all pervading. It brings you good smell and also bad smell. But wind itself is not affected by any of this. So if one can live in this world, work in this world, and still remain non-attached, you can remain in this world, and this game of life becomes a drama which you witness and not participate in. You may be living this world, but mentally, if we can try to practice this non-attachment, not being affected by all these stress, anxieties, all these problems, one can have perfect peace and happiness, as we found in the life of the great sage. About 2 minutes, it looks like an ocean. The entire world and all its activities, all the manifoldness exist, but he remains completely unaffected. This is the lesson that the sage learned from air. Now, then the sage said, the third lesson was given by sky. I said, I may not go through all the 24 teachers, you know. But I shall just a few important lessons I will try. Sky. The question arises, how does sky become your teacher? If you observe the sky, you find sky is omnipresent, all pervading. Again, the ideal of non-attachment is trust here. Sky may be apparently, not really, filled with clouds and dust and all that. But really, sky remains completely unattached. And then, in another context, one important teacher that the sage mentions is sun. Sun is one of the teacher. Now, how does sun become the teacher? Sun gives light to all beings in this world. Sun is responsible for absorbing water and becomes vapor, and again it comes down in the form of rains. So sun also becomes a teacher. And again, ocean is also given an example. Ocean remains unaffected. Then there are a few other examples given. And one example given that is very important is fish hawk, osprey. It's a small bird which catches fish from rivers, ponds and rivers, and goes about flying. And then what happens? See, the sage says, if the bird catches a fish or a piece of meat and flies in the sky, there will be other birds chasing it, trying to get this fish or piece of meat from it. It will try to attack him. But the moment this osprey drops this fish, then all the other birds which are chasing, the chasing birds will go away. Similarly, if one completely drops attachment and becomes non-attached, then life becomes an experience of eternal happiness, peace and tranquility. This is the lesson which the sage learned from this osprey. And this book is, this lesson, this episode comes in the devotional classic. I won't go through all the details. I will continue some other aspects of the same lesson. But before concluding today, A very important subject I want to deal directly with, the subject of meditation. How Swami Vivekananda interprets meditation? Because it is Swami Vivekananda who first gave the very concept of yoga to Western world in 1893. So he has said and he has written a lot about the concept of meditation based on the teachings of Bhagavad Gita and also some other well-known books like Patanjali Yoga Sutra and all that. I shall read a few very important and relevant portions of Swamiji's teachings and will try to explain. They deal directly with the subject of meditation. In one of the earlier articles, Swamiji compares the mind to a lake. I shall read this here. The bottom of a lake we cannot see because its surface is covered with ripples. Swami Vivekananda compares human mind to a lake, and all the waves, all the dust and all the weeds perhaps may sometimes accumulate on the surface of this lake are compared to different sensations and impressions that we normally accumulate in our mind. And meditation is an attempt to clear, to weed out all this accumulated dust and filth which get accumulated on this mind lake. This is the comparison. So the bottom of a lake we cannot see. See, we cannot really understand how our own mind operates because there are so many impressions and ideas and memories which are accumulated on the surface of the lake. So we cannot see the bottom. It is only possible for us to catch a glimpse of the bottom when the ripples have subsided and the water is calm. So when water becomes calm, we can see the bottom. And what is the process of making this water calm? Meditation is the only way we can try to see the bottom of our own mind. If the water is muddy or is agitated all the time, the bottom will not be seen. If it is clear and there are no waves, we shall see the bottom. The bottom of the lake is our own true self. But because of all this way, all this accumulated filth and dirt, we are not able to see. In fact, it is the Atman, what in Sanskrit is called Atman, but on the surface of it, all these vrittis, impressions are accumulated, and this is what we normally call mind. Here, one point to be remembered that is related to meditation. Mind, according to Vedanta, is not an entity. It is only an operation of human impressions. When our self is completely freed from all waves, all impressions, then mind no longer exists. We learn to identify our mind with our consciousness, Atman or self. So mind is only a concept in Vedanta. Mind is not an entity. It is only a concept. The moment you are free from all these ripples and waves and accumulated impressions, then mind ceases to exist. Only Atman exists. But so long as these impressions remain on the surface of the lake, we do not see the bottom. We are not able to realize that there is the consciousness, the Atman behind all this. Again, the mind is in three states, one of darkness called tamas, found in brutes. Then Swami Vivekananda divides mind. Mind in the normally found among animals and people who are almost like animals. They have no idea of any higher wisdom. Then there are people who are very active. Their mind or these impressions and waves become active. In Sanskrit we call it Rajoguna. Tamoguna is the inactive, inertia state, and Rajoguna is the active, dynamic state. And when mind becomes calm and quiet, then it becomes Sattvaguna. And then we are just one step near the realization of the inner consciousness. Then Vivekananda speaks about controlling mind. He says, meditation is one of the great means of controlling the rising of these thought waves. Because by meditation, we are trying to slowly clean up this mind lake. If you take, if meditation is sometimes compared to an attempt to stir up this lake, while stirring, many undesirable things may come to the surface. So when you try to meditate, those of you who are trying, you find sometimes very undesirable thought currents may come to the surface. Terrifying thoughts, disturbing thoughts. But those who teach meditation may tell you, we should not be affected by that. We need not be terrified, we need not be disturbed. Because if you are disturbed, then again that will lead to further disturbance. So we must let these thought waves come to the surface, and as a witness we must be able to stand aside and watch as these thought waves come to the mind, come to the surface. Then slowly when we are established in complete non-attachment, when we are not at all affected by these emerging thought waves which come to the surface, then they stop coming. And slowly mind calms down. This is the technique Vivekananda prescribes. And he says, one important attitude for anyone who tries to meditate is an attitude of perfect cheerfulness. Perfect calmness and cheerfulness. Any miserable look or an attitude of helplessness or wretchedness or utter feeling of misery will be a great obstacle in spiritual life. Vivekananda writes, the first sign that you are becoming religious is that you are becoming cheerful. Again, this cheerful attitude is not an attitude of joy. A child will be very happy if he gets a chocolate. So also a grown-up man struggling to acquire wealth will be very happy if he suddenly gets $1 million. It is not that kind of. An inner sense of tranquility. So the first sign that you are becoming religious means should be taken as spiritual in that sense. Religious persons are not necessarily very cheerful. Sometimes they become very grim and maybe the very antithesis of cheerfulness. What Swami Vivekananda means here is perfect spiritual attitude, not confining to any particular doctrine or dogma. If a man is becoming spiritual, he becomes cheerful. When a man is gloomy, when a human being is gloomy, that may be dyspepsia, but it is not spirituality. So he says, to the yogi, everything is bliss. Yogi here should be understood as a man of steady wisdom, we already explained. Because Bhagavad Gita equates a man of steady wisdom with a yogi and also with a great devotee, with a real mystic. So mystics, yogis, men of steady wisdom, they all belong to the same category. So here Vivekananda says, to attain this cheerfulness, meditation is the only process. And to the yogi, everything is bliss. The world itself becomes a playfield, as in the case of this enlightened man who learned all his lessons from external world. We'll go back to the subject next occasion. Now that is the sign of a virtuous man. Now remember, you know, anyone who grows in spiritual life will have a feeling of inner tranquility, and that will express itself in the attitude of perfect cheerfulness, a kind of inner contentment. If you are a devotee of God, and if you think that you are surrendered to God, and if that God is merciful, and if you feel miserable, there is something absolutely wrong with this. This is absolutely against logic. If God is the protector of the world, if you believe in God, and if God is all merciful, and if you think you are a devotee of God, then that feeling, well, I am a devotee of God, should give you a sense of inner bliss, cheerfulness and happiness and tranquility. This is to be attained through the path of devotion, and this can be attained through the path of mental control, through pranayama as they call it, breath control, and also by observing nature. That's what the great sage, his name was Dattatreya, who realized the supreme truth. What business have you with clouded faces? It is terrible. So Vivekananda says, when we try to meditate, we must have an attitude of perfect peacefulness and cheerfulness. We must pray, let there be peace in this world, let there be peace in everyone, let all the beings, living beings, be happy, let them live in perfect happiness and tranquility. A kind of inner prayer will make ourselves peaceful and tranquil. Then here Vivekananda gives an idea of how to identify a man who actually meditates, how to identify the signs of a yogi. In fact, Vivekananda writes a letter that these are supposed to be signs of a yogi. One may ask the question, well, these are all characteristics of an advanced spiritual personality, but we are not advanced. So all the great spiritual teachers, including Gita, the teacher of Gita, says we must try deliberately to acquire these characteristics ourselves. Then we will become yogis. We will attain perfect wisdom, steady wisdom. So what are supposed to be the attributes of a great man of steady wisdom are the goals. They constitute the goal for every spiritual seeker to attain. So he who hates none, who is the friend of all, who is merciful to all, who has nothing of his own, who is free from egoism, who is even-minded in pain and pleasure, who is forbearing, who is always satisfied, who works always in perfect communion with the Supreme Consciousness, whose self has become controlled, whose will is firm, whose mind and intellect are given up to the Supreme Reality, such a one is my true devotee. Vivekananda is quoting a verse from the Gita. So an attitude of perfect tranquility, peace, calmness and harmony and friendliness with the entire creation should be the attitude that we must develop before starting the process of meditation. Then now Vivekananda, in another context, gives some practical hints on meditation, and he also refers to the technique of focusing our mind on a sublime object. Here is a dialogue between Vivekananda and one of his disciples. What is the real nature of meditation? So a question is put to Vivekananda. So, well, if you want to see the picture of a meditation, this is Vivekananda's picture. Maybe one of the most sublime representation of a man of meditation, we can see. So he writes from his own experience. Vivekananda says, meditation is the focusing of mind on some object to begin with. Because without some object as a point of focus, we cannot start meditation. Because meditation involves the process of withdrawing our senses from external objects. This becomes easy if you have a sublime object to focus on. So he says, if the mind acquires concentration on one object, it can be so concentrated on any object whatsoever. Now discussion, here is a discussion. What should be the focus of meditation? Because meditation can be done without an object and also with an object. It's called savikalpa, nirvikalpa. I won't go into those technical details. What Vivekananda says is this. Meditation becomes easy and natural for a beginner if there is a sublime object. This object can be the figure of a great mystic. It could be a sacred word from any religious, spiritual literature of any religions in the world. It can be a sublime idea. Anything which is universal in outlook, which is free from hatred, which is free from any kind of negative characteristics, which is sublime, which is beautiful, and which is all-inclusive, which gives you an idea of universality and unity, becomes an object of meditation. It need not be a visible object. It should be a sacred word, or sacred, we call sometimes mantra, a prayer from the Bible, from the Gita, from any religious spiritual literature in the world. Or for those who don't believe in any of the scriptures, it could be a sublime idea. Or a sincerity to get spiritual enlightenment, as in the case of Dattatreya. This sage says he did not have any focus of meditation, but he had intense desire, a strong desire to become universal, to become broad-minded, to become spiritually enlightened. And with this attitude, when looked upon external nature, nature itself becomes a great teacher. So for that, an attitude is necessary. So you need not always believe in a particular book or doctrine or anything. If you have a strong, sincere desire to become spiritually enlightened, to become a great, humane person, universal in outlook, broad-minded, with a sublime philosophy of life, then nature itself opens its secrets. Nature itself becomes a supreme teacher. That's what is meant here. And there are just a few other aspects which I shall. Then now here, there is a very interesting statement about proper time for meditation. What's the appropriate time? In theory, anyone can meditate any time. But the great ancient teachers have pointed out that sometimes nature can become helpful in the practice of meditation. You must practice at least twice every day, and the best times are towards the morning and evening. One reason given by the great ancient sages is this. In the morning and evening, when during the time of sunrise and sunset, nature is calm and quiet. There is an air of tranquility, harmony and peacefulness in nature. Now this positive, helpful environment can be properly utilized by a spiritual seeker if he tries to meditate during the time of sunset and sunrise. When night passes into day, and the day passes into night, a state of relative calmness ensues. That is, nature itself provides an appropriate, favorable condition for meditative process. The early morning and the early evening are the two periods of calmness. The body also becomes calm, so mind. Your body will have a tendency to become calm in the morning and evening. We should take advantage of that natural condition and begin then to practice. For a beginner, an appropriate, favorable external condition is a must. Otherwise, mind will become highly disturbed. So make it a rule not to eat until you have practiced. So this is very important. See, one should, if there is something which we never avoid, a meditative process should be somehow linked to that. So breakfast is something that we normally don't want to avoid. So if you make it a point, we will never have breakfast before meditation, then meditation becomes naturally, it becomes a natural part of our daily routine. Of course, in many other spiritual books related to meditation, some rules are given with regard to food, etc. The general principle which all great teachers have laid down is we should be moderate with regard to food. Fasting too much will be as much as an obstacle as feasting. The best example you can get in this context is the life of Buddha himself. You may have read Buddha's life. So when he left his kingdom, he straightaway walked to the forest regions, and there on the bank of a river he spent several years in terrible, unbearable austerities, without taking food, without even drinking water, without even eating leaves even. Slowly, first he started eating only once, then that also he stopped, like that. Then it is said that one day Buddha was trying to climb up the steps after his bath in the morning, but he could not. His body became so emaciated. Then suddenly, in a flash, it struck him that, well, these terrible physical austerities have not enabled me to get enlightenment. You have to remember Buddha's original decision. There is a famous life of Buddha which is called, you know, Ashwaghosha Buddha Vijaya, it is called. There is a famous Sanskrit verse which it is said that Buddha recited to himself before he started all these austerities. ഇഹാസനേ ശിഷ്യതി മേ ശരീരം ദുഗം സ്ഥി മാംസം ച വിലയം ചെയ്യാത്തു അപ്രാപ്യ സിദ്ധിയും ബഹുജന്മ ദുർലഭം നൈവാസനാൽ കായം അതശ്ചലിഷ്യതേ. ഐ ഷുഡ് ട്രാൻസ്ലേറ്റ് ഇൻ ഇംഗ്ലീഷ്. ദിസ് ഇസ് എൻ ഏൻഷ്യൻ ബുക്ക്, ഏൻഷ്യൻ വർക്ക് ബിലോങ്ങിങ് ടു സെക്കൻഡ് സെഞ്ചുറി എ ഡി. സോ ബുദ്ധസ് ബയോഗ്രാഫർ സേസ് ഐ എം ഗോയിങ് ടു സിറ്റ് ഹിയർ, ലെറ്റ് മൈ ബോഡി പെറിഷ്, let only be bones be left out, let my body perish. Even if my body and everything perishes, I shall not get up from this seat till I get to spiritual enlightenment, which is the rarest thing in this world. This is roughly the literal translation of this verse. I'm going to sit here. He took a strong decision. And even if my body perishes and falls away, I shall not get up from here before I get spiritual enlightenment. And this was what happened to Buddha. Buddha suddenly realized, well, extreme austerity is not the way to spiritual enlightenment. And also extreme luxury is equally a great obstacle. So all great teachers of science of meditation are unanimous in one point. One should practice moderation, neither eating too much nor fasting. In Gita there is a famous verse, yukta ahara viharasya yukta cheshtasya karmasu yukta supna avabodhasya yogo bhavati dukkha. The literal translation is this. This yoga here should be understood to mean supreme spiritual enlightenment, which is the goal of meditation. This experience is not possible for those who do not practice moderation in eating, in activities, and also in their habits. So if you fast, if you physically torture you, the body consciousness will be a terrible obstacle. And if you feast, then also body consciousness will be a terrible obstacle. If you are hyperactive, then you cannot become an enlightened man. If you are lethargic or lazy, then also it is not possible. So a degree of moderation should become a philosophy of life to be successful in meditative life. This is a view which is unanimously accepted and recommended by all great teachers of meditation. And then one must pray, let all beings be happy, let all beings be peaceful, let all beings be blissful. So an inner prayer for the good of others, because that gives you the feeling that creation is one. You are in perfect harmony with the entire creation. Inner harmony. Because any kind of negative emotions like jealousy, envy, hatred, any such things become a terrible obstacle in meditative process. Because whatever may be our attitude of life gets strengthened and reinforced through the process of meditation. Because meditation sharpens our mind. Whatever may be your faculty, whatever may be your attitude, it gets strengthened and reinforced through meditation. Because mind gets focused. So your ability to work and attain whatever you want to attain will be increased by meditative process. So before starting this meditation, one should always practice a sense of inner contentment and sense of inner harmony with the entire creation. That's why Patanjali and other great yoga philosophers have laid down, one should have internal discipline and also external discipline before taking to meditative life. I think we already see the time. And we will have meditation for half an hour, and then during interaction I can discuss the subject for that time.
Yuvantapravishyamamavachamimam prasuptam sanjeevayati akhilashaktidharaswadhamna अन्यांश्च हस्तचरणश्रवणत्वगानीन् प्राणान् नमो भगवते पुरुषाय रूपिम. Let us meditate on the supreme reality, which is the essence of the entire creation. Om peace, peace, peace.
Why do we use the word dhyana for meditation?
Yes, dhyana is the Sanskrit term, but I was not very sure that everyone may be familiar with that technical term, you know.
Is it the same as samadhi?
No. Dhyana, dharana, samadhi, these are the three stages of meditative process. Dhyana is the first advanced stage. When you are able to focus your mind completely for 12 seconds, you know, like that. And Dharana is, if you can do that much longer time, 3 times or 12 times, like that, different interpretations, for a long time. And Samadhi is a state when you get yourself completely identified with the object of meditation. There is complete unity, identity between the meditator and the object of meditation. Before that, there is always a difference between the object of meditation and the meditator. In Samadhi, you attain complete unity. It's called Dhyana, between Dhyata is the one who meditates, and Dhyaya is the object of meditation. So Dhyana, Dhyaya, identity is achieved in Samadhi. The object of meditation and the meditator become one.
Would you spell it, please?
Dhyana. Dhyana, yes. Dhyana. I shall read and explain in detail right now. It's all these ramifications. Just. The simple point is, my devotee never perishes. That message is emphasized here. It comes in the 9th chapter, 31st verse. Kshipram bhavati dharmatma shashvatshantim nigacchadi kaunteya pradijanihi name bhakta pranasyati. So the Lord says, aham pradijanihi, I am promising to you. What's the promise? Me bhakta na pranasyati, my devotee never perishes. Now, I shall explain, read the translation and explain. A devotee, even if he is a sinner, still if he worships me with real faith and devotion, is in fact a good man, because he has taken the right resolve, he had taken a decision, he had taken a right move towards me. Because even if you are a sinner, even if you are sinner, you know, these are terms used, please, I should just warn you at this point. The word sinner here is not used in the same sense in which it is used in some Abrahamic religious literature. He means somebody who has done something wrong and he feels that he has stolen something, or he has told a lie, or he has disobeyed his parents. It may not be a sin perhaps, you know. Some small mistakes. These are the ideas. It doesn't denote what is normally understood by the word sin in the biblical literature or any other monotheistic religious literature. It is entirely different. Because in the earlier verse, Lord Krishna says, Apiche Suduracharo Bhajadeimam Ananyabhag Sadhurevasa Mantavyaha Samyak Vivasido Hisaka. The idea is this: if a man is, if he feels that he has done something wrong, stealing or it's some anything, you know, and he feels defeated, well, what will happen to me? Krishna says, even such a man who may have committed some undesirable things in his life, undesirable deeds, if he resorts to me, I shall protect him, because his devotion to me will slowly change his mind, transform his mind, change his attitude, and that devotion, that changed attitude, will help him from desisting from similar actions in future. And in continuation of that idea, Lord Krishna says, very soon, kshipram, dharmatma bhavati, very soon, without much delay, this man who has done something wrong will become a righteous man. He will become a man of virtue. He will not commit any further. He will not commit such things in future, because his orientation, his devotion to me will bring about a total change in his life and attitude. So very soon he will become a different man. He will become a virtuous man. And then what happens? He will attain lasting peace. Sashrut Chandim, lasting peace, everlasting peace. Because his devotion to me will completely transform me. The idea is this: when you do something wrong, and then, well, out of a sense of repentance or guilt feeling, you pray to God, whatever may be your idea of God, that prayer will bring about an inner transformation within you. And from a Vedanti point of view, this God to whom you pray is not different from your own Atman. From a Vedanti point of view, you are not praying to a God who creates this world and stands away from the creation. That God is your own inner consciousness, your own Atman, your own self, ultimately. So when you turn to that reality out of a sense of devotion, slowly an inner transformation begins to take place in your life. So the transformation always takes place at the subjective level, not objective level. In fact, any kind of whatever religion you may belong to, you may practice, or even if you don't practice any religion, even an atheist, then also, if you really feel, well, I have done something wrong, I should not have done it, you are actually turning towards your own inner self. Even if you don't believe in God, that's the greatness of Advaita, is its doors and windows are open even to non-believers. Because you can deny God, you cannot deny your own inner consciousness. You can't say, I don't exist, you don't say. Because God is the supreme existence, knowledge and bliss. So from an Advaitic point of view, any sincere feeling, well, I have done something wrong, I should not have done it. If there is sincere feeling, the man begins to change. Transformation begins. And that change will ultimately take him to complete transformation, and he will attain complete inner peace. That's why my devotee never perishes. My, the word my is used. See, may means my. Idea is used here, but according to Advaitic interpretation, it means the Atman. You are turning towards your own Atman. This idea begins. And you become a different man. So this is a great promise that God makes. You can interpret it in purely theistic way. But God is all merciful. God is your protector. So why should God be always angry with you because you have done something wrong? But then how can you say that God is merciful? So if God is merciful, then he should also forgive you. So this idea behind. In fact, if you read Augustine's Confessions of the City of God, he says real confession is the beginning of true transformation. The original idea of confession. Because the moment you feel you have done something wrong, you are realizing that you should not have done it. Otherwise, you don't realize that I have done something wrong. The moment you admit that you have done something wrong, it is associated with another strong conviction, well, I should not have done it, because you recognize your action as something wrong, which means you feel you should not have done it, which means you realize that it was not the right action. That's the idea. So Advaitic interpretation is also very supreme. The moment you inwardly, from your inner consciousness, you feel that you have done something wrong, that's the beginning of your transformation. And Lord Krishna says, he is my devotee, he will never perish. In fact, the idea of perishing does not exist in Vedantic religion. You don't perish. In Vedanta, Vedantic philosophy does not believe in theory of evil. It believes in theory of error. You do something wrong, not because you are evil, but because you are ignorant. Ignorant that you are the Atman, Supreme Consciousness. So you do something wrong. The moment you realize you are Supreme Consciousness, you cannot do anything wrong. So Vedantic philosophy believes in theory of error, not in theory of evil. It's a basic difference.
There is another verse,
Uddhaya Atmana Atmanam. Atmaiva Khyatmana Bindhu, Atmaiva Yupur. It comes in the sixth chapter. The idea is this. Well, I can read and explain. Anyhow, would you mind? Is there anybody else? Any other doubt? Because, you know. Anybody else? Otherwise, I shall come back to you.
One question. Krishna uses the word my devotee, and you spoke of devotion. But in a way, then you're interpreting devotion really is an issue of attitude. I mean, you could interpret this in a non-emotional manner and say, when my attitude becomes properly directed.
Right. Yes. You know, I was trying to follow the Advaitic interpretation. But, you know, Vedanta has got three main streams. Of course, there are seven different schools of Vedanta. I'm referring to extreme dualistic school of Madhva and the Advaitic school of Shankaracharya, I mean the non-dualistic school, and the qualified non-dualistic school of Ramanuja, Visishta Advaita. There are other Dvaita, Advaita and so on, Vallabha, Limbarka, Chaitanya and so on. I'm not coming to that. Now the idea is this. From an Advaitic point of view, me, mama, my, these are the terms, you know, me means mine. Mama also means my. My means in me. Always interpreted by Shankaracharya, the great non-dualistic philosopher and commentator, as Atmani, Paramatmani, Brahmani, etc. So Advaitic interpretation will always imply that the moment I realize that it was due to my ignorance that I did something wrong, you begin to change and you start your spiritual journey. Your evolution starts. Because unless you realize that it was due to ignorance or avidya that you did something wrong, you will not recognize your act as something wrong. That is the Advaitic logic. So out of my ignorance, I did something wrong. So when you realize that you were under the power of avidya, you come out of avidya. When you are in ignorance, you don't realize that it was wrong. The moment you realize that it was wrong, it means you are out of ignorance. That's the idea behind it. So Advaitic interpretation is aham is atma, mama is atmanaha, brahmanaha, and mai is brahmani atmani. Always that term is used. I mean, this context, wherever in the Gita the Lord Krishna refers to himself, I, my, etc., the idea is belonging to Atman, inner consciousness, self, not to a God who creates this world. But it is acceptable. Advaita never contradicts the views of other non-Advaitic schools of thought. It completely agrees with the views of Visishtadvaitins and Dvaitins. But it says, at a higher level, when you progress from the level of differentiation to a level of identity, you realize that you are one with Supreme Consciousness. And when you realize that you are one with Supreme Consciousness, you also realize your identity with the entire creation, then you cannot do anything wrong. Vivekananda's statement, the infinite oneness is the eternal sanction of all morality, all ethics, all good actions. So you cannot do anything wrong if you are an Advaiti. Because you cannot do anything wrong to anyone. You cannot injure your own hand or your own leg. Shankaracharya says. So this idea. So perfect identity of entire creation, the attitude, entire human family is one spiritual entity, is the basis of the highest ethics. Therefore, the man becomes a different man, he changes. And such a devotee never perishes. This is a great prayer. Now, Uddhare Dātmana. Any other? I'll come to that. It comes in 6th chapter. Chapter 5th verse. The verse is this: Uddharet Atmana Atmanam Na Atmanam Avasadayet Atmaiva Hyatmano Bantuhu Atmaiva Riburatmanah. The central message is your mind is your own friend and your mind is your own enemy. Now by concentrating on your higher nature, you should bring down or you should neutralize your lower nature. So na atmanam avasadaya means never let your mind go down, because generally, you know, in our mind there are different impressions, different samskaras, different tendencies and attitudes. If we become a slave of our lower nature, then spiritually we go down. So we should never let ourselves be brought down by our lower nature. We should always try to uplift our lower nature to the higher nature by concentrating on the higher nature. So that's why one should not downgrade one's own self by becoming a slave of our own lower nature. Because in fact, your own self is your mind and also your enemy. But the question arises, you know, yourself, the word is used. Where the word Atma is used in this context, Atma is interpreted by commentators as mind, not a Paramatma, Supreme Consciousness. So, see, I have to point out one problem with this text, you know. These classical works were written and they originated at a time when philosophy had reached a very high level of progress, but language was in its stage of infancy. See, language was not so highly evolved in those days, but philosophy was highly evolved. So what happens? Language was not equipped for expressing all the high philosophical ideas. So you find the same word is so often used to denote different things in the Upanishadic or Vedic literature. So mind is sometimes implied by the word Atma. But here, the idea is you should never let yourself be brought down by the lower nature, by your lower mind, lower tendencies, lower attitudes. So try to uplift your lower mind to a higher level by practicing spiritual practices, by following spiritual practices like meditation. You can give a lift, you can upgrade, you can uplift your lower mind to a higher mind, and spiritually you can elevate yourself by spiritual practices like meditation. Because if mind is your master, you is your worst enemy. If mind is under your control, he is your best friend. It's a simple idea. If you are dragged about by your mind, then you will be naturally dragged about by your senses. And then mind acts as your worst enemy. Mind tells you, I want this, I want that, I want to do this. Even if that action is not desirable, your mind will tempt you, do that, do that. That mind is your enemy from a spiritual point of view. The mind which is under your perfect control is best friend, because that mind will take you only to positive ideas and actions. Side effect. Any other? Yes.
Mohiji, can you address the topic of direct realization or enlightenment that someone like Ramana Maharshi spoke about?
Excuse me?
Can you address direct realization of the kind that Ramana Maharshi spoke about, and is that attainable or
yes.
For regular people?
Yes. Ramana Maharshi himself has said, and he has written, he had a tragic experience in his life. The death of his father was most unexpected. So it came as a shock to him. So that made him think of the perishable nature of human body. And he also realize that there is something which doesn't perish along with the body. At the time of cremation, body will be burnt, but there is something which will remain intact, which is imperishable. Now, this event, suddenly, according to him and according to Vedantic tradition, suddenly awakened his inner consciousness. His memories related to his previous life and the spiritual practices that he had undergone in his previous life suddenly awakened, and that's how he started his journey to Arunachala. So according to Ramana Maharshi and according to Vedantic tradition, it is related to rebirth and law of karma. Otherwise, in every day, people die, but we don't get Ramana Maharshi every day. And you know, sometimes we feel grief when people die, but very soon we forget, and again we are brought back to this relative world. So death is a real reminder of the perishable nature of the body, which alone dies, but along with that, it also reminds you of the imperishable nature of something, or which body was only a vehicle. This is what Vedanta says. So Ramana Maharshi must have been practicing a lot of spiritual sadhana, spiritual penance, meditation and all, in his previous life. And then he must have passed away. Such people will be born in families where spiritual culture is prevalent. In the Gita, there is a verse where Lord Krishna says, in answer to Arjuna's question, Arjuna puts a question to Krishna, what happens to those who practices meditation and spirituality? And what happens if they die before they attain their goal? And there are two types of spiritual aspirants which Arjuna refers to in this question. The highest type of spiritual aspirants, like Ramana Maharshi, as he was in his previous life, they practice spirituality, they practice meditation and other spiritual practices, but before they reach their goal, they pass away. Such people will be born in families where there will be a very happy environment conducive to spiritual life. They will be born to parents who are naturally imbibed in spiritual values, who will train their children in spiritual practices. And then, once they remember these previous life and experiences, and once they suddenly remember that they have been practicing great spiritual sadhana in previous life, suddenly they get an awakening and they take to spiritual life. This one. So Krishna, Arjuna asked this question in the 6th chapter. What happens to those who sometimes commit some mistake and they fall by the wayside and then die out? Lord Krishna says, those people also have got a chance. They will be born in families where their unfulfilled desires could be fulfilled. People sometimes fail in attaining the supreme spiritual goal because of their attachment, because of their desire. Well, what happens? They will be born in families in those conditions where they can fulfill what was left unfulfilled in their previous life. And after fulfilling those desires, they get a new awakening. So, whatever one does, it remains intact as a deposit in the spiritual bank. Whatever you do, even the minor, in the minutest, even the simplest spiritual practice, if you meditate one day in your life for 1 hour, that will not be lost. Because that will remain. It is never late and nothing is lost. That is the message of Vedanta. So even the minutest practice, Krishna says, even a little practice of some spiritual sadhana, some spiritual practice will remain intact. It will not be lost. And in course of time, if you get an opportunity to enrich, to reinforce what you have already practiced, it becomes more powerful, If not in this life, the next life. That's why nothing is lost. Ramana Maharshi's case is a classic example of a great spiritual person who have attained a very high level of spiritual enlightenment in previous life, but must have passed away. And in this life, an ordinary event which normally never brings about a transformation in the life of common people suddenly became an instrument, a tool in opening, in reawakening his spiritual consciousness. And then he travels to Arunachala, an ancient Shiva temple, and goes to the temple and he proclaims, "I have come here." And then he goes to a cave and he meditates there for years. And he became Ramana Maharshi. So, it's a classic example. Such examples can be found in all spiritual traditions. Nor in the lives of many mystics in Western tradition are also examples. I hope it's already time 9:05. Om, peace, peace, peace. Om, shanti, shanti, shanti. Sri Ramakrishna.